Hello, innovators, explorers, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. And on today's podcast, I am interviewing Dimitri and Marcel from Subsquid. At Subsquid, they are building really needed infrastructure for Web3. They are building indexing of data. So just like how Google and Yahoo back in the early days of the internet indexed all the data on the web so people can search it, they are doing this for on-chain data, for blockchain, for the data that resides on blockchain. So if you are a developer or a founder of a project or a VC active in the Web3 space, then this episode is for you. Also, nothing mentioned on this podcast should be taken as investment advice, and I do not run any ads on this platform. So my only ask is that you share this episode on your social like LinkedIn or Twitter. With that out of the way, let's get into it. So Dimitri and Marcel, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here. Looking forward to talking about Subsquid. But my first question is, how did you guys get started and what does Subsquid do? So Dimitri, I'll start with you. So yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Hi everyone. And thanks Sam for inviting us. Yeah, it's a pretty long story how I actually met Marcel and how Subsquid started. We actually met before at the previous startup called Helix that Marcel founded. I joined the startup first as a part-time researcher and then as a scientist who develops the protocol for IoT data. I think Marcel can talk a little bit more about this branch of history. Unfortunately, this IoT startup didn't quite take off, and during the bear market in 2020, we parted our ways for quite some time, and I joined another Web3 startup called Joystream, who's been building decentralized YouTube, and in particular, they had this big issue of having all the data that they were storing on-chain to be quickly available for front-end. Essentially, if you are building a consumer-facing application, one of the most important things that you should care is the response time and that all your web pages or the mobile application really flies, right? So you don't really want to tolerate any kind of latency. And this makes it imperative to have a caching, or what people like to say, indexing for the data that normally is stored on-chain, because retrieving this data from the chain is super slow and super complicated. So you actually need this middleware which serves this data as fast as possible. And this is essentially what indexing is all about. And back then, there was already the graph, but the platform that they were building on was not supported because it was a substrate-based chain and a Polkadot ecosystem. So we started to think how to find an alternative solution. And I started building an indexer on my own. And after a few tries, I quickly realized that one of the key challenges and the bottleneck for building an indexer is to actually ingest the raw data from the chain, because every time you change something, you have to backfill the same data over and over again from the very beginning, and gets very annoying because it is rarely the case that your first iteration of the indexer is the final one. So it's always a lot of changes. You want to change the schema, you want to change, do it some data field in your API. So this re-indexing and backfilling speed is really an essential metric. And I came up with this rough idea of having all this raw data from the chain stored specifically in an additional storage for where this data can be retrieved, filtered, and so on pretty quickly. So like the first solution was very simple. It was based on Postgres, where I put all the data they needed, and then the indexer was eating this data from there rather than from the chain. It was like pretty successful. So like we built our first prototype. I also presented it in a hackathon and won the infrastructure track. So it was like got some initial attention. Apparently, this internal product got also attention from different projects that got exactly the same problem. And yeah, at that time, it was clear that there is some demand for this, at least in the niche of Polkadot. And yeah, around that time, out of blue, Marcel just texted me on Telegram and said, "Hey, what are you up to? The market is heating up. I got some interest from investors. Let's try to do something." And I say, "Oh, actually, that's really great timing because I have this idea. It is clear that it is overgrown the frame of the internal project, and we discussed that if we have funding and resources, I can basically branch it off into a separate endeavor because it was open source from the very beginning anyway." And yeah, all the stars basically aligned, and this is how we built Subsquid.
Oh,
And
that's
yeah, this we went really far from that because this first iteration was very simple, and now we iterated 5 times over the idea that the data for indexing and pretty much for everything blockchain related should not really come from the node, from the RPC. It should really come from a specialized solution which would be decentralized, high performance, linearly scalable. And this is exactly what we've built with Subsquid, which is called right now Subsquid.
Oh, fantastic. Marcel would love to hear your story as well. How did you first get started? What was it about the Subsquid idea that really attracted you, or the problem that attracted you?
Okay, yeah, hey, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. And I think Dimitri already had a great introduction to how we met. Nevertheless, I'll give a bit of background as well. So, yeah, I've been in the space since around 2016, like 2016. I come from a computer scientist family. So, my mom, my brother, and my dad all are computer scientists. I'm not a computer scientist. So, I basically first went for like design at the design school, so I have a Bachelor of Design. Then later on, I started studying mathematics. I dropped off to found my first startup with my brother back in the days, which was called Helix. As Dimitri mentioned, was an IoT startup, IoT intersection to Web3. Unfortunately, also as he mentioned, we didn't really find product market fit. And then in the bear market, we had to liquidate. And yeah, lessons learned. So after that, I decided to go for business education because I thought, you know what, I think it makes sense to like strengthen the fundamentals, strengthen the financial education, and really understand how it works operating a business. Then all of a sudden, I just reached out to Dimitri and asked him like what he was up to. He mentioned that he's working on this indexing protocol. At that time, I had no clue what indexing was. He basically said, "Look, it's similar to the graph." I said, "Okay, great. This company's worth billions of dollars. I still don't understand what it does." And then he basically explained to me, every time you load your favorite wallet, you load your favorite app, basically there's a backend powering this. I was like, "Oh, wow. So this is like really crucial infrastructure." And I said, "So what's different? Like, why is this needed, what you're building?" Then he explained to me they're different, like there are EVM chains, they're non-EVM chains, there's substrate-based chains. And back in the days, Polkadot was one of the most upcoming like ecosystems, had a lot of traction, a lot of hype and buzz around it. And he said, "There's literally no indexer for this ecosystem, especially not a high-performant one." And so I started understanding how crucial this was. I also went back and tried to understand how Google and Yahoo back in the days actually started. And from my perception, they started as indexing protocols. They started indexing the World Wide Web, basically enabling it for consumers nowadays, because without a search engine, nobody would be able to query the internet to get like the information he wants. And I was like, "Wait a second. So we're basically building something similar to Google, but for blockchain. This is sick. This is like amazing." And that is when I told him, you know what? Like some of the investors I had access to, who I knew from my other startup, they really liked me as a person. They knew I was like hardworking despite not making it like a profitable endeavor at first. And they said, "You know what? If you have anything else, let me know." And that's when I introduced Dimitri and the idea, and we got the first backing in. And from that point on, yeah, I could continue to speak now for hours, but that was like the starting point in early 21, I would say, around like Q1 21. That is when everything kicked off. And then by summer 21, we started like building the team, got more funding in, and yeah.
That's fantastic. I'm just trying to appreciate how well you explain that it is like how Google indexes the, like how they started with indexing the Web2 world. You are doing the same thing for the Web3 or the blockchain based world. There's often a criticism that I've heard about some of the Web3 projects, or back, even back in the NFT boom, I heard that, okay, yes, NFTs are not completely decentralized for a lot of the projects. It would only be the link that's on chain, which is pointing to the storage in AWS where the image is, or music file or video file or whatever is held. So it is still the same centralized thing. Whereas Dimitri, you mentioned about it being decentralized, what you are doing. And then, but at the same time, earlier versions of it, you use Postgres, which is just like a centralized database from my understanding, just like MongoDB or one of these. Then how is it still staying decentralized? Can you please, Dimitri, shed some light on this?
Yeah, certainly. This is actually like a multifaceted question about yes. The trade-offs between decentralization, what we actually mean by some decentralization, right? And what components we actually have here. So first of all, decentralization, right? So let's try to decompose what it means. First of all, that means there is no single point of failure. Which means, and this is probably the most important part in when we speak about Web3, because we assume that our services are unstoppable. So yeah. This aspect of decentralization means that we have multiple copies of our services run across the world, so that due to this redundancy, if some of the nodes goes down, our data can be served by someone. This is not really a Web3 concept. So, for example, AWS or Google or Cloudflare have this redundancy.
Azure or lots of them, yes.
Yeah. So there is more to it. So another aspect of this decentralization is openness, which means that anyone can join to the network and anyone can use data that is in there. So it is not really sealed into one of these Google or Amazon servers, but rather the data is accessible. So, for example, anyone can read Ethereum data either from the chain or from another, say, database. And finally, when we go to decentralized finance, for example, and other applications, decentralization means that anyone can spin their own instance. So, for example, if you're banned from using uniswap.io, because, for example, you're from the US or like from Cuba or like from Russia, it is still possible to spin your own UI.
Yeah.
And interact with exactly the same smart contracts and essentially bypass the limitations that the official web front end is imposing into you. So it's really about inclusiveness. So speaking of this regarding the indexer, like why having Postgres is really okay, but not the best solution. So first of all, what are the benefits? It is fast, it is easy, and as long as we are dealing with read-only data, and there is a certain way to validate this data, at the end of the day, it's not even that important how exactly this data is stored, because there is a single source of truth, which is the on-chain, and you can think of it as more like of a cache, which facilitates. But at the same time, if this Postgres is stored somewhere and there is no easy way to build this infrastructure on your own and like host it somewhere, this undermines this openness and inclusiveness. So the approach that we eventually have taken is to replace this ground data layer, which originally was just like simple Postgres, but a decentralized data lake, which means that all the data that we serve for a subsequent network is spread into smaller chunks of data, and these smaller chunks of data are spread around all the nodes that are in the network. So if any of these nodes goes down, another one can pick up the job and serve this data.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
there are, yeah, and there are incentives which tell that if the node it misbehaves, and for example, doesn't follow the protocol rules, the bond can be slashed. And since they earn rewards by providing the resources to the network, they're incentivized also to serve this data in the most efficient way. And there is no central authority who can basically censor or limit access to this data. So anyone can put the data in, read it from there, and this is our final vision from here. And on top of that, you can build different products. So for example, you can build centralized cloud solutions, something that we built at Subsquid, which is called Subsquid Cloud, yeah. Which allows people to use it the way that they are used to for Web2. You can use exactly the same thing on your own in-premises infrastructure, or you can use a completely modern Web3 stack where you would utilize decentralized compute power, a decentralized database, for example, like Quill or VFTB, and for the indexing layer, you can use Akash or a lot of Fed contracts. So
yes.
The stack is really then depends on your particular needs and your kind of spectrum of decentralization. But the key bottleneck, the data, is solid and decentralized. And this is the key goal of the subsequent network, to provide this building block for everything else.
That's fantastic. My next question is actually for Marcel. So who is the main sort of user that you generally reach out to? Is it like a developer? Is it other Web2 startups? Probably Web2 startups for Subsquid Cloud, but maybe for SDK developers. I don't know. We would love to learn a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. As we teased before, almost everyone, like every startup who's building a DApp, so anyone who's actually interacting with on-chain, like with the chain,
yeah,
needs on-chain data access. So ultimately, and I know most people will say this doesn't seem very precise, but it's the truth. It's like everyone who builds in Web3 is a user for us. Obviously, we have certain use cases which we see more often than others.
Yeah.
When there was the NFT hype, we saw tons of NFT marketplaces coming up, making larger for community or like user base, I would say 1 or 2 years ago. Then we saw a lot of wallets going on, analytics platforms. And nowadays, I would say it's a mix and match of almost everything. So we have a lot of DeFi, DEXs, we have NFT marketplaces, we have wallets, we have analytic platforms, and also other ecosystems reach out to us. For example, I don't want to mention any names right now, but like large L1s, L2s, which just are seeking for support to get their chain covered for their developers. So this is then like another part of the user base. So it's not only directly B2B. We also have a bit of B2C with like independent developers who are maybe just tinkering and trying to build something by themselves, or who are just like building their own analytics dashboard. So yeah, everyone who needs on-chain data is served by Subsquid, and we support almost every major chain at the moment. There's two missing, which is Solana and Cosmos. Solana is coming very soon. I would say hopefully by the end of Q1, it is out of beta and available to public. And then Cosmos is going to hopefully come later this year. And then we have probably everything covered. So we have then Solana, we have Cosmos, we have EVM, like all major EVM chains, and we have all Substrate-based chains. So I would say easily 100 plus chains we support.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really good to know. I can see why you would want to be known with developers as the go-to tool to solve this problem. So how do you get in front of developers? How do you attract developers? What has worked for you? Again, it's a follow-up question for you, Marcel. So,
yeah, perfect. I can tell you what has not worked. So what does
yes.
not work
oh,
with
would
developers?
Love to learn that as well.
At least from our impression so far is being very pushy, having performance marketing. This is something we noticed that did not work for us. It might work for other companies. For us, it did not so far. Maybe our ads weren't good enough. Maybe marketing wasn't great. But what we noticed is that it's basically just, it cost us money, but there's not much result in it. What works really good is word of mouth. So ultimately, how did we grow to hundreds of different clients and like hundreds of projects using Subsquid? Ultimately, it started with a handful of projects using us. And through word of mouth, people liked the tool, they recommended it to other developers. That's how we built credibility. And in case you didn't know, like, we started in 21, now it's 24. So like over 3 years later, now things are like picking up, right? We're seeing a lot of more momentum. So it takes time to build this user base. And the next thing which we've noticed, which works pretty well, is having a good developer relations manager. So
10%.
Yeah, in your team, which basically goes to events, speaks developer language, not a business person trying to sell you something. No, a developer going into different developer communities, seeing issues, and then offering solutions and offering this kind of like support. And then people, again, accredit this and really like your tool more than, for example, a company which just like spams you with emails, or a company which spends hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on advertisement. Because with Web3 in general is already quite small, but the Web3 developer community is even smaller. It is very hard to target these people. Word of mouth, I would say DevRel, and event marketing, it really depends on which events you go to. And here, what we've learned is paying $20,000 to $100,000 for a booth, in most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, is not worth the money. It makes more sense to use this budget as a startup to go to more events and actually go to side events and like just speak to people and spread the news. And I think that is one of the keys, like key metrics or like key marketing activities we made over the last couple of years, which helped us grow.
Yep. Can I share my experience as well?
Sure, go ahead.
In this, because I worked for, or I was founding team of one of the startups in this space, where our product is like a developer tool used by developers to create smart contracts and so on. So it's okay. So my role was to help them get started and get developers like from 0 to 6,000. And as you were saying, most people don't realize how small the developer community is. I don't know if you read the Electric Capital's developer report that comes out once every year. It's only 30,000 full-time developers. So it's like every chain, their lifeblood is the developers, because the more developers develop on it, that means the more people, the adoption they will get in future. It's like everyone wants the developers and everyone is trying different things. Like people are throwing bounties at hackathons, like the ETH Global hackathons that happen everywhere. They are trying to do all sorts of things, but DevRel is number one thing that you do, and have lots and lots of educational type events to support developers. That's what works. And also collaborating and partnering with tools that developers already use. So that's what I did, is I got them have a strong collaboration with things like Remix IDE, Chain IDE, lots of IDEs, because that's one point that where every developer has to use an IDE or does uses an IDE. And also one more point on where you said that the ads don't work. And I'll tell you the reason why they don't work, because developers are the most tech savvy people in the world. And they all use an ad blocker, the most advanced ad blocker. They all use VPN. They all use things like that. So ads, when you're targeting geolocation, anything, that's not going to work. And the third thing is that our community is decentralized. Like, we are building decentralized products, and it has taken the decentralized ethos to the max. Most Web3 companies I talk with, they never had a physical office, because a lot of them were actually born in 2021 in the time of lockdowns, and they preach the gospel of decentralization. They cannot be centralized and ask everyone to come to the office every single day. It's every single team I talk with, they have decentralization to their core. People still need to work and meet people, and how they do it is by going to events. And that's why there are all these events all around the world, like ETH CC, ETH Denver, Token 2049, all these. And they have hundreds of side events. If you see the side event list, there's ETH Denver probably has 180 this year, or like about that many, 150 to 180. Token 2049 in September had 440 plus side events within a week. So it's that's where people meet, connect, and fulfill that human connection need by going to the events, and then rest of the time go back to their basement and start coding and code and do that. So yeah, you are right. You are like 100% right in your assessment of the developer community. Dimitri, you are a developer. Would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I would also, yeah, so first of all, I think it's really a great strategy to build integration with the tools that developers already love and use. And we just recently announced, for example, plugin that allows AveWorks users to leverage the power of Subsquid Network.
Yes.
I'm pretty happy to finally see this plugin live because I'm a big fan of AveWorks. Yeah, a really great tool, and people use it for data a lot. And right now, they can just use all the data from our network for free, and they'll speed up their pipelines 10 times without really changing anything almost in their code. Yeah, and also I would say that VAST3 is also pretty much tribal. So
it is very tribal.
A lot of products, they are very dependent on the persona. So being very present on Twitter and now on Farcaster and other applications is crucial to the success of the product, because people sometimes just look at who is behind. It could be just an anon avatar, still, as long as it's very active on Twitter and engage a lot, that kind of builds something of not a cult, but following. And it's super small, super tribal, and very interesting dynamics. I don't think that this is something similar in the crypto world.
That's fantastic. Talking about how something that both of you touched on a little bit, like how in 2021, there was the whole growth in the whole NFT ecosystem, and that's where people were using Subsquid, and then later came wallets and then marketplaces, and you can see a little bit of noise around Solana and Cosmos. It feels like the industry moves in narratives every year. What are some of the other trends that you are seeing? Dimitri, you can go first, and then Marcel, I'd love your opinion on this as well, that you are seeing that will shape the industry in the next couple of years.
I would say that it is clear right now that people are really interested in bringing Web to normies and build consumer apps in Web3.
Yes.
So we have the success story of Farcaster, success by Web3 standards.
Yes.
I think it's pretty quick. Before that, we've seen France Tech, which also took the space by storm. I didn't quite live for long, but everyone that attracts normal people, and where you don't really have to wait 1 minute for a transaction to confirm, actually catches attention. So it is clear to me that the future is where we have more and more consumer-facing apps, which means that we have better user experience, higher TPS, better product design, better UX, and at the end of the day, people will probably not even realize that a lot of things happen on-chain. But for us, that brings more and more data, because if your chain is 15k TPS, it's just simple math to calculate how much data it produces. And this data then should be stored and queried in a decentralized way. And I believe that we're pretty much the only company on the market who takes like this approach seriously, with the expectation that it's going to easily hit petabyte scale. And we do not want to sacrifice decentralization in what is even more important, probably composability of this data. So you can basically mission match different things from different chains, from different applications, decode this data, bring in off-chain data, for example, price feeds, weather, I don't know, inflation data, and build truly decentralized applications on the truly decentralized data.
Yep. I have one more question for you, follow-up, but first I want to hear Marcel's view on where he thinks what the narratives will dictate in the next 2 years, over the next couple of years.
Obviously, this is very speculative. So
yes.
There are two things, like the hot topics right now, and something which I would personally like to see take off. So the hot topic right now, which I know also from my non-Web3 friends, is like DePIN. So like this decentralized physical infrastructure, like things like Helium. And I know the first time my friends talked about blockchain, like the ones which are like absolutely no coiners, that was when a local newspaper talked about Helium, I think 1 or 2 years ago. They were just featured in a small German local news. And my friends told me like, whoa, isn't this like on this blockchain technology? And wow, it seems like it's taking off now, blah, 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 blah. And then they were like interested and they bought their first coins. And actually one of them even started like running these nodes for them, like spreading the infrastructure. And I think these kind of use cases, especially because we do have a small IoT background, are interesting. I'm really curious to see how these things are going to really take off and shape the future. And another topic, which I'm personally more attached to, is definitely gaming. So I do have a very extensive gaming background. I still like to game by times if I find the free time to do. And so far, Web3 gaming, in my opinion, was more or less like a letdown. It was very focused on just like creating some, it was more like play and not play to earn. So like the game mechanisms weren't really, the games itself weren't really great compared to like normal games, which we see like from AAA studios or other, let's say games which are published on Steam. And yeah, they weren't really good. And I hope this is going to change in the future. So it's actually play and earn. So there are games you want to play because they're actually really good games. And then you earn something on top of it. Or like for me personally, we don't always need to have this earn mechanism. It can be something else, like just that maybe the blockchain infrastructure and having it decentralized will give you some kind of a benefit when like owning items or armor or whatever you like generate in the game. But here I still have to be also convinced fully, because I've never had this feeling in my life where somebody told me like, I don't own something which I created in, or which I've earned in a game. Yeah, that's fine with me if I don't own it. Like as soon as I play the game, I have access to it. And so I'm a bit curious to see where this all goes. I would really like to see gaming take off. Why? Because it's super consumer focused and it's going to bring a lot of activity on chain. We just have to figure out how to do it. And I think one step in the right direction, and I know a couple of teams working on this right now, is actually building great games which people like to play. And having something
that's
which
the number
people
one
like.
Thing.
Exactly. And not like, how can we get this token inserted into this game to somehow generate money and sell this token to investors in order to make more money for them? No, it should be like, okay, how can we create a good game? What is needed to create this good game? And is blockchain a solution to create this good game? And then, yeah, that's something I would be super, super interested in.
Right now, what has happened in the last few years, because I've worked in gaming DAOs and I've been a gamer, I've built an esport platform in the past. It's the problem is that as soon as you involve money and people start playing it purely for money, it becomes work and not play. That was one problem. And then also because of how founders approached it, it was like tokenization was the main goal, game was an afterthought. We need game as the main dish, and then tokenization is just like the cherry on the top. It's the main deal as the game. And it's there are AAA studios, but it is possible for a small team, like 3-4 people, to create a good game. I don't know if you saw the success of Palworld in the recent time. It was done by 4 people or something like that. It's became a massive global hit. At any time, there's 1 million people at peak, or even more than that, or 1.2 million were playing that. It's so much bigger than even Ethereum. Ethereum's got 300,000 daily active users or something like that. It's crazy to that once you have gaming, it brings in like tens of millions of people. Even one good game will do that, but we have to build a good game first.
We had Axie. Yeah, we had Axie until they ran out of Steam and it gets money like to pay the gamers. It was
So Axie didn't have players, it had workers. They were able to, they were like, it is like sweatshop and people just go to earn money pretty much. So they weren't gaming. When you have gamers, they will even pay money to play the game. They don't care because there is fun and it became work. So a lot of things end up becoming work. So I think a good Web3 game would put data on chain for that interoperability, so that you can move it around. and build a good game without even a token. So it's still using, and then a token can always be implemented later on at a later stage. But yeah, just coming back to SubSquid, and what's some of the biggest challenge product-wise that you have faced, Dimitri?
Product, not technical challenges, product challenges.
Yeah, product or technical. Could be product or technical.
Yeah, because for us, the thing is a little bit more peculiar because we have this super tech-heavy backend, I would say, which is a SubSquid network. And we have products, which is the SDK and the cloud, which basically abstracts away the complexity of the decentralization. And there, the challenge is really to figure out the best possible ergonomics for the developers, like how you decode this raw data, how you manipulate this data, how you make these transformations. And it is a whole dev UX challenge on its own. And there we tried different things. And of course, like, one really has to have this intuition, even building a nice command line interface, it's an art. Because you can just like put all your features and people would never even discover them. They would never even know how to use this. And another like challenge is to make good documentation for it. So it's discoverable, it's easy to navigate for the developers. It's like one, from one side is more like a book that you can read, and it's, and your goal is to make it a page turner. So it's not really boring, but it's also informative and straight to the point. So it's also like an art, doing great documentation. We put a lot of effort there. And on the technical side, of course, there are a lot of challenges which are already hard to solve in the situation where we have full control over the nodes. Like, for example, building Spark cluster or something like Snowflake data lake is already a really big challenge. It's billion, multi-billion dollar companies like who build this data lakes and service. But if you additionally, on top of that, add this requirement that each node can be Byzantine and they can live and go, you don't really have any assumptions on for how long they stay in the network, how much latency they have, whether, so you don't really have control over anything, so it is harder to roll out updates, patch fixes, bugs, and also like the whole communication complexity goes aloof. And here, building SubSquid network wouldn't be possible without the recent advances in data management tools, especially DuckDB, the advance of the Parquet format for the storage of the data, PyArrow for transferring a large amount of columnar data. So all these advances, which are slow to come to the Web2 world because the existing solutions are good enough, became very handy in Web3, where the world is still at the stage of just using Postgres, so to speak. And for Web2, for example, we have this like huge company, Mother Duck, which has got, I think, almost 100 million in funding. Maybe I'm wrong, but like definitely north of 50 from A16Z and like all the big ones.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. And what about for you, Marcel? What's the biggest business challenge that you have to face?
Usually, as we all know, like Web3 is very, there's cycles, right?
Yes.
And from a business perspective, especially at the beginning, in general, like still up to date, most large Web3 companies don't make money. They don't really make a lot of revenue. Luckily, like developer tooling infrastructure, these kind of startups, it's a bit easier to make money compared to other verticals. But at the beginning, nobody makes money. So what happens is you have to, when you enter the market as a startup, either you have a very strong background with a lot of traction and your VC network, you make a call and you get funding, you get a lot of funding, you're backed for the next couple of years. This is the 0.1%. For the remaining 99.9% of people who are founders, they, if they found a company in a bear market, it's almost impossible to get funding, very hard. So I always recommend people to look at the cycle. Right, for example, right now is a good time to start. And the main challenge there then is managing the funds accordingly. So understanding the cycles, knowing, okay, probably we're going to enter a bear market soon. That's what happened to us in 21, 22. When we raised, it was, I would say, the end of the bull market. And we've noticed, okay, we're entering a bear market. We should not scale up the team. I know we have the money, but we should not scale up the team. We should stay as we are and first analyze the next couple of months, keep building, don't spend money on marketing, and to just ensure that we're going to survive the bear market. Luckily, we were even able to raise during the bear market. This is not what most people do. So that was one of the major challenges. And I think due to our experience with the old company, we knew that this challenge was going to happen and we knew how to react to it. So this was one of them. Another one is probably regulations. Again, here we are based in Switzerland. Everything is fully regulated and therefore for us, not a big deal anymore, but also a lot of founders I know, in order to save money at the beginning or because they don't want to commit fully, they go with workaround solutions, which basically means either they have no entity at all, or then basically they found an entity in their current country. Let's just assume, for example, you live in Germany or you live in Poland, and then they just open up an entity, start operating from it. And at one point, the damage is done and it's really hard to revert everything. And then it costs you even more money to do so. I think setting up everything correctly from the beginning is another very important thing and challenge many people are facing. And then the third challenge, and I think this is the biggest one, is that constant rejection. So you have to get used to getting rejected constantly. This is from developers. This is from VCs, even from your own VCs. They start questioning yourselves like, hey, like 1 year later, why don't you have all of these big clients yet? It's not that easy. And then they say, but this other company is now trending. Great. That doesn't help me. And we've witnessed this a lot as well. Even our own VCs saying what's going on and why didn't it take off already? And this is very challenging by times. And also something which I've learned personally in Web3, it's not about, it's not only about having traction. So for example, when we get audited and stuff, we show how many clients we have and we say, look, we've grown 30% month on month. And now we're at 150 clients, paying customers. And they're just giving some metrics here right now, random metrics. And then they're like, okay, great. But look at this new shiny thing over there. Look at Frentech. I said, we are an infrastructure company. We're indexing protocol. How can you compare us to a consumer app? Yes. And what I want to tell you is the TLDR is Web3 is always looking for the next new shiny thing.
It is.
And most of the times, at least indexing is not this new shiny next thing people care about, right? So we constantly face this challenge where people are just more interested in the new shiny thing opposed to the crucial infrastructure. And I always give the example of the Tower of Pisa. Right? It was fundamentally built wrong. And this is what happened. Sure, build your next consumer-facing app, build your next game. But at one point, if you really scale and you really want to have Web2 mass adoption, you need the right backend. You need the right infrastructure in place. Otherwise, it's going to collapse. And it is, I would say it is hard by times saying this over and over again to VCs. And many of them just jump onto the next hype train. So it's, oh, this is backed by Paradigm. This must be great. And no offense, Paradigm, great investors. Would have loved to have them on our cap table as well. Seriously. But a lot of people don't do the due diligence. They just jump onto the next thing. Kind of brain dead. And this, especially for me, is a challenge because I am managing our investor relations. I'm also looking for new funding, creating the presentations, and it was difficult by time. So those are the three major challenges I think we faced and are probably still going to face moving forward.
Yeah, because our industry is so narrative driven and every year has different themes and then everyone just follows those themes. But there is still value in building and solving problems, even if it is. I've had this criticism, I used to criticize that Web3 in past as well, that hey, Web3 is only solving Web3 problems, it's not solving real world problems. But then I was talking with someone and he said, yes, that is true, because it needs to solve its own problems first before it can go. It's like it needs that infrastructure in place first before people can go and build that killer app that everyone is looking for. So it is needed. So that's why I think SubSquid is needed. Having said that, what is your biggest ask at the moment? Is there any one particular thing you're looking for? Are you looking for more like hiring, funding, anything? Feel free to share. So first, Marcel, you can go. And then after that, okay. Same question for Dimitri as well.
I assume we're going to probably ask the same thing now. I would say one of the big asks is hiring. So luckily, we're funded well enough. Also, we started switching to a paid model last year. So we are generating revenues. We're actually making money in Web3. Isn't this great? No. So I think the most challenging, one of the biggest challenges is hiring the right people. So what we've learned is hire and fire. And it takes time to find the right people. And now as we recently had a successful sale on CoinList, was like generating, I think, around 7,000 to 10,000 new token holders. We now want to use a bit of these funds to scale the team, getting ready for the launch and just getting bigger, but not too big. And I think that this is one of the major challenges right now. And yeah. So Dimitri, anything else from your side?
Yeah. So when it comes to an ask, I think I would rather make a wish that people just go crazy, go creative, and don't really spin another L2 roll up, because 200 other roll-ups are not really good for some reason, or I don't know. Yeah. Make another clone of Uniswap on some obscure L2 because you can make some money of it. So at the end of the day, yeah, my wish is to have a lot more interesting applications and make them actually make money, right? So instead of just like spending their VC budgets or some fat that they got from the bull market to really find out how to make the thing work without really just like burning the funds and attracting people through airdrops, rather than getting real users. I believe that within the next 5 years, we will see this kind of maturation of the space where that would also bring finally the actual users, not only to these consumers app, but also for all the infrastructure products that are currently right now building for the future, not for the present, by and large.
Yeah,
that's... So, yeah, my wish is for this future to finally come.
That's a very big, but it's good. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put all the links in the show notes to your website, to your socials, to everything, so people can and developers can reach out to help you build this vision that you have for the Web3 and the blockchain-based future or on-chain-based future. So yeah, with that, I'd just like to thank you both, Dimitri and Marcel, for your time. Thank you so much. And yeah, wish you best of luck.
Thanks a lot for having us.
You too. Yeah, was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Tamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. Then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.